In my view of life, one of the great rewards of being human is the possibility of romantic love. Of course, to succeed in romantic love, healthy self-esteem is very important. But let me first explain what I mean by romantic love, because I have a very special definition which requires a bit of spelling out. When I speak of romantic love, I talk about an intense, spiritual, emotional, sexual attachment or connection between two people that reflects a high regard for the value of each other's person. Now, what I'd like you to notice is that each of the words or phrases there has a very important meaning packed inside it. One of the characteristics of romantic love is that the two people tend to feel a strong sense of affinity, the sense of a spiritual connection, the sense we look at life the same way. We feel some of the same things are important. We're soulmates. So there's that feeling of a real spiritual connection or a spiritual affinity, in the absence of which, whatever the relationship might be, it's not what I mean by romantic love. There is further an emotional connection, a strong emotional attachment, a reaching out, a longing to be emotionally involved with the other person. In the absence of that, whatever we're talking about, it wouldn't be romantic love. There is certainly a sexual connection, a desire for sexual interaction with the other person. Again, let's allow for normal fluctuations in feelings. One doesn't feel sexual desire toward a partner equally all of the time. But if there's not some significant feeling of a strong sexual attraction for the person, it could be some other kind of love, but it's not what I would mean by romantic love. Last but far from least, what do I mean when I talk about a high regard for the value of each other's person? I can hardly exaggerate the importance of admiration to romantic love, and certainly to successful romantic love. If two people are bound together by sex attraction mixed with mutual contempt, which happens all the time, I don't call that romantic love. One of the characteristics of romantic love is that the two people really esteem each other. They really think each other is terrific. They admire that person. And over the long haul of a relationship or a marriage, you may be sure nothing is more important than two people respecting each other. Because a relationship can weather a lot of storms, can handle a lot of adversity, if the people admire each other, but if they don't, it can be knocked off by relative trivia. And that, too, alas, happens all the time. Sometimes in therapy, when I'm discussing this issue with a client, and the client is saying how much he or she loves the partner, I will say, fine, now, do you like your partner? And there's a long, dull thud of silence, an embarrassed silence, and they realize sometimes, no, I don't. So what they're calling love is really some kind of maybe very dubious, I hesitate to say an erotic, bonding or attachment. But what gives it all away is the fact they look into their hearts and they say, do I really like this person? No. Another interesting question, another aspect of the same thing, which I find very interesting to ask, for example, a man, if you were a woman, is she the kind of woman you think you might like to be? Or to a woman, if you were a man, is he the kind of man that you feel you might like to be? If the answer is an enthusiastic yes, that is about the most hopeful, positive thing you could ever hear for the likely success of a relationship. If the answer is a vigorous no, that's very bad news for a relationship. You look at people who are really happily in love and manage to be happily in love over long periods of time. You watch their eyes when they look at each other, and you will see an admiration and a feeling that is, we say, that's my kind of man, that's my kind of woman. The idea that if I were a man or if I were a woman, that is the kind I would sort of like to be. Now, if all this makes sense, probably it's clear why I said at the outset that successful romantic love requires a reasonably good level of self-esteem. But now let me elaborate on why I say that, because it's absolutely central. If I feel lovable to myself, I don't find it an incomprehensible miracle that you might love me. But if, in contrast, I feel essentially unlovable to myself, You can stand on your head to make me believe that you love me, and I'll always want more reassurance, and I'll never really quite believe it. I'll never quite be able to accept it. We've all heard the saying that in order to love another person, we must first love ourselves. This is completely true. It's only half of the story, however. The other half is, in order to love another person successfully, in order rather to believe that the other person loves us, we have to love ourselves. We have to feel lovable. We have to feel that we are deserving of love so that we can accept it with grace and ease as something natural and not as some highly suspicious miracle that can vanish at any moment. Again, if I have good self-esteem, if I'm self-respecting, I'm likely to treat you with respect and to treat you well, which, of course, will nurture the relationship. If, in contrast, I don't have good self-esteem, I am very likely to feel, since I don't deserve anything good, I'm very likely to pick somebody who's not going to treat me that well. And when they treat me badly, part of me is going to feel, but of course, this is natural. This is all I deserve. What else is there to expect? One can say even more. You know, we human beings live by self-fulfilling prophecies. If I don't have good self-esteem, if I feel I'm not lovable, nobody could really love me. But all that semi-unconscious, let's say, consciously I say, sure I deserve love, sure I want love. So I meet somebody and I fall in love and we're happy together. But inside, after a while, a little voice says, hey, something is wrong. This is not meant to be. This is not my story. My anxiety begins to go up. I begin to feel disoriented because I know it's not my destiny to be happy in love. Now, I know right now it looks like you really love me and it looks like we're really happy, but I know this is a mistake and I know it's not going to last. And I'm tired of enduring the anxiety of waiting for something to go wrong, so I will now proceed to do something to make it to go wrong. I will start becoming hypercritical or jealous or mysteriously depressed or remote or withdrawn or start chasing after other women or do God knows what. But the point is, I will find some way to turn you off or drive you away so I can start singing alone again naturally. Life is just the way I always knew it would be because, you know, human beings, if we have a choice between being right or being happy, we love to say I'd rather be right than happy. So if I know my story is not to be happy but to be miserable and alone, I will bring that about. I will engineer it. I will turn you off. Or if for some reason you are so persistent and you keep saying, well, I don't care what you do, you lunatic, I love you, I'm going to hang in there, whatever, and I cannot drive you away, next best thing is I can make us both very, very miserable. So we can struggle for love, we can dream of love, we can read books on psychology, we can go to a marriage counselor. But meanwhile, right now, thank God we're miserable. Why do I say thank God? Because reality is in alignment with my view of the way things really are. I know it's not my destiny to be happy. I know I don't deserve to be happy. I know nobody can really love me. I know life's not going to go right for me. And see, it isn't going right. And I'm completely blind that I have orchestrated and engineered my own defeat. And so these are some of the reasons of why healthy self-esteem is essential for success in romantic love. A question I'm often asked is, can being in love help self-esteem? And that's a complicated issue. If we are alone and we would like to be in love, we're not likely to be as happy as we would be if we had a good romantic relationship. True enough. But other things being equal, most of us are happier if we're in a good love relationship than if we are not. The tragedy of many people's lives is that they imagine that if somebody else loves them, that will make them feel lovable to themselves, and it doesn't work. First of all, because poor self-esteem people tend to fall for and to attract other low self-esteem people, and then they create a nightmare together, sometimes called marriage. But beyond that, if you don't feel lovable to yourself, somebody else telling you they love you never feels fully convincing, never gets all the way in. You sabotage, as I was saying a few minutes earlier, you do things to undermine it. However, let's suppose you've got a reasonably decent self-esteem, and you're just lonely. And now you meet somebody, and you have the presence of mind to fall for somebody who's got a pretty good level of self-esteem, too. Then, through the love, through the opportunity to nurture this other person, to be loving to this other person, to receive love from this other person, more of yourself begins to blossom, you feel more alive, you start to act in new ways. you can confirm self-esteem, you can nurture self-esteem, you can enrich self-esteem, you can flower as a person, but you can't create a self-esteem the essence of which was not there in the first place. So what it can do is make a person with a gift for happiness happier. It can make a person with the essence of self-esteem more evolved, more developed, more fulfilled. But somebody else's love cannot pinch it for your love for yourself. And that's what people need to understand. When we love another person, some degree of intimate participation in that person's life, and certainly a concern with that person's needs and welfare, is very natural, healthy, normal, and desirable. Some people carry this impulse to excess. And statistically, I would guess that women do so more frequently than men, because women are socialized more to think in terms of relationships as creating the primary meaning of their life. Although I've seen men make this error as well, and generally speaking, it seems to come out of a certain kind of insecurity, out of some deficit of self-esteem, out of some feeling that through you, I will achieve identity. Through you, my life will have meaning. By myself, I am nothing, or close to nothing. Only in connection with you might I acquire some meaningful sense of identity. Probably this is the commonest reason. However, I can think of situations where A and B fall in love, A and B get married. Even if both work, only one of them, let's say A, has a real passion for the life of the work or the career. B has a pleasant job, but there's not a same degree of passion. Therefore, B might be more emotionally involved in A's work than vice versa. I wouldn't call that pathological or dangerous. That might be totally appropriate for them and comfortable for both of them. So you might say that in some ways B immerses her or himself more in A or in A's work than vice versa, but that would not necessarily be harmful in any way. It's only harmful under this circumstance when the person who's doing the immersion is neglectful of true and genuine needs of the self, true and genuine needs for more independence or autonomy or self-actualization. If it's you at the expense of me, I don't think that's healthy for the individuals or the relationship. We hear a lot today about fear of commitment as part of the problem of fear of love. I'll never forget some years ago, I was on promotional tour for a book of mine called The Psychology of Romantic Love. And I was being interviewed by a 28-year-old newspaper reporter. And she said to me, "Dr. Brandon, I'm kind of fascinated that a man in his 50s is talking so enthusiastically about romantic love. Doesn't it scare you?" "I," she said, "would be so scared to fall in love all the way or to commit myself to one person." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Suppose it didn't work. Suppose he left me. Suppose I got hurt." I recall being stunned because of the youth of the person asking me the question. And, of course, it says something right away about commitment. It says fear of commitment is placing the fear of disappointment above the possibility of joy, the fear of hurt above the possibility of happiness. Sometimes this happens. A lot of us grew up, we saw our parents have an unhappy marriage. We saw most people's marriage fail. Maybe we ourselves got hurt during our younger years. And we said two calamitous, dreadful, dreadful words to ourselves: "Never again." Two of the saddest words in the language. So life now becomes about not being hurt rather than about living. The greatest challenge to human beings in the universe is the challenge to stay vulnerable. the challenge to stay open to the possibilities of life, the challenge to retain the ability to be excited about the possibilities of life, because all of us get hurt, all of us get knocked on our back a number of times in the process of growing, all of us get banged up, all of us get betrayed somehow, somewhere, by someone. Some of us far worse than others, obviously. And the real test, for me, of our humanity, the toughest test any of us will ever have on this planet, is can I stay open to life, can I retain my excitement, even when I've been hurt a lot or disappointed a lot? The fear of disappointment, the fear of hurt, the fear of pain, the fear of rejection, reasons, of course, of the fear of commitment, except for one other motive, which I'll mention as a kind of postscript. A number of people have unconscious death anxiety. That is to say, an unconscious fear of death or dying that they have never dealt with. And one of the forms it can take in their life is a fear of growing up or the fear of being an adult, on the premise that if I remain a child, I can't die. Grown-ups die, not children. Almost as if I don't commit myself to anything, a work, a person, a cause, my life hasn't officially begun yet. So the clock has not yet begun to tick until I'm ready to say, this is it. So sometimes the treatment for fear of commitment is helping a person cope with his or her unrecognized death anxiety. A few years ago, a niece of mine in New York City got married. And at the party following the ceremony, she stopped by me and she said, "Well, Unc, do you have any words of advice on what it takes to have a happy marriage?" I thought, what could I say in the middle of a wedding party? It had to be a pretty good one-liner, no time for a lecture. And what I said was, well, maybe the most important thing for the success of a happy marriage is the courage to stay in the ring during a confrontation or an argument when you're really scared and you don't know how this conversation is going to end and you don't know whether you can solve this or not or where this might be leading to. Because what we typically do in relationships when we're hurt or scared is we withdraw, we shut down, or we lash out blindly and disown how much we love the other person, almost protecting ourselves in advance against an anticipated hurt, after which we proceed to behave in rather stupid ways that can really destroy the relationship. So this goes back to what I said about the courage to remain vulnerable, doesn't it? Can I stay open to you even if right now I'm angry as hell at you? Can I remain open even if I'm really scared maybe you're going to fall in love with somebody else, maybe we're not going to solve this? Can I stay open even when I'm badly hurt by something you've done? Can I stay connected with how much I love you even at the same time that I'm angry or hurt or scared or whatever the case may be? Having counseled couples for 3 decades now, and having, as I said, written several books on relationships, I've always been very interested in the question of whether or not there are particular behaviors that we tend to see among couples who have managed to stay happily in love or married for long periods of time that might differentiate from the behavior of couples whose relationships flounder. And there are some behaviors that do tend to be different. And you find these pretty consistently. For example, we find that couples who remain happily in love over long periods of time are likely far above the average to tell each other that they love each other or some verbal equivalent. Or again, couples who manage to remain happily in love for long periods of time tend to convey a fair amount of non-sexual affection in addition to sexual. They tend to be affectionate, physically nurturing, with stroking, with patting, with fetching a blanket, with fetching a cup of tea unasked. Couples who are happily in love tend to attach a significant degree of importance to the sexual aspect of the relationship, and that's not so much an issue of frequency, which varies a great deal among happy couples, as it has to do with the importance that they invest the act with. That old-fashioned phrase, "with my body I thee worship," is a phrase that has emotional meaning for them. And that might be true whether they make love 5 times a week or 5 times a month, do you see? They tend to be a strong emotional support system for each other, again, far more so than the average. They tend to say it differently, to be each other's best friend, to know that if something is wrong, I can talk to you, you can talk to me, I'll be there for you, you'll be there for me. Another very important behavior that you find among couples who have been happily married for a long time, the relationship has a very high priority in terms of time. They create time to be alone together. They don't let work or social relationships or family obligations swallow them up. They spend a lot of time by themselves just doing things together, having fun, talking, walking, whatever they like to do. I remember once I was at a university, Northwestern University in Chicago, giving a lecture on romantic love, and I was talking about the importance of leisure, of time together, for the success of relationships. And after the lecture was over, a young couple came over to me, very enthusiastic about the talk. And they described themselves very much in love, which they looked like they were. But the man said to me, "You know, Dr. Brandon, I really like what you had to say, but one thing puzzled me. How do you have time to spend alone with your partner?" I said, "What is your occupation?" He says, "I'm a lawyer." And I said, "You love your wife?" He says, "I'm crazy about her." I said, "You know, that only one thing puzzles me. Given how much you love your wife, how do you have time to maintain a law practice?" And he looked at me with his jaw dropping, quite nonplussed. And I said, "That's a bewildering question, isn't it? That question makes no sense. I mean, that's idiotic. You have to make time for your law practice, don't you? Because that's important. Therefore, it would never occur to you to say, 'How can I have time for my law practice given how much I love my wife?'" I said, "Well, when you're willing to treat the relationship as important as you treat your law practice, you won't ask me how I find time. You'll know how." So, one of the characteristics of couples who remain happily in love for long periods of time is they understand it's now or never. They participate in much higher levels of mutual self-disclosure than the average couple does. They share more of their internal feelings, internal life, internal processes, and they're interested in each other's thoughts and feelings and processes. What'd you do today? How'd you feel about it? What are you feeling right now? They like to share their whole internal world much more with each other. The average couple is oblivious to what's going on inside each other. Therefore, they shouldn't be surprised when the relationship does not end up happily. Trouble is, romantic love gets a bad rap, most unfairly, for people's irresponsibility toward love. People think that, well, all I have to do is find you and I love you and everything will be automatically terrific. That's not how it works. You need a very high level of consciousness to succeed in romantic love in exactly the same way that you need a high level of consciousness to succeed in your career. The problem is, people understand this about careers. They don't understand it too often about romantic love. When a couple in love decides to have a child, it's really important that each understands that new challenges have now entered the relationship and new potential sources of strain for romantic love. Children, needless to say, can be a wonderful source of pleasure, excitement, reward, fulfillment. It's also true that they are time-consuming. They are sources of irritability, tension, strain, fatigue, financial drain. And a couple has to join ranks, as it were, against the problems that can sometimes attend the arrival of children in terms of new stresses on the relationship. Sometimes the father gets to feel jealous because mother now divides her attention. She's no longer just a wife, she's now a mother. I remember many years ago seeing an old Tarzan film, Tarzan Finds a Son, I think it was called. When they find this baby in the jungle, the Tarzan and Jane adopt. And Jane gets all excited with this little infant. And she notices that Tarzan is feeling just a little bit jealous because her attention is now divided. And she does something very skillful. She makes herself busy with something else, and she asks Tarzan to do something for and with the baby, to look after the baby. In other words, she enlists him in participating in taking care of the baby so that it becomes their project and not her project. And it's all done very, very simply and very, very skillfully, but it really does illuminate something interesting about what an intelligent couple needs to be aware of. They really have to be partners, because otherwise it becomes a division between them rather than a new uniting force between them. I believe that we need to be first husband and wife, second father and mother. And if we reverse that priority and start thinking of ourselves first as father and mother, the marriage and the love suffer. I don't think it's good for the couple. I don't think it's good for the child. There's an interesting paradox to romantic love. Only when and if we're comfortable with our aloneness can we really be able, fully, happily, consummately, to participate in romantic love. We're led here again back to the supreme importance of self-esteem for happiness. Because one of the things that self-esteem asks of us is that we take responsibility for our own existence, which is a way of saying that we recognize in what ultimate sense we all are alone. And where would love be if it were different? The whole excitement of love, the whole thrill of connecting with another person, the whole wonder of falling in love takes its charge from the fact that we are ultimately alone. That's what makes it such an exciting miracle when we do fall in love and it works. But if I'm fighting my own aloneness, if I'm fearful of the responsibility of individual identity, if I try to merge with you when I have no real self of my own, I will be over-dependent, I will be emotionally parasitical, I will be exploitative, in the popular parlance, I'll be a drag. The greatest relationships are created from two strong individuals who really enjoy themselves and enjoy being alive, and then they share this energy, this liveliness, and this excitement. Two vacuums cannot join to create a great love affair. That's the bottom line. First, there is a self. Then, the exquisite experience of oneself encountering another. But first, you must have a self. First, you must be an entity. First, you must be you. Then you find someone enough like you for love to work.